You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluids?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness. Who wouldn't stand next to me at a march?
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Let me first say that when I was growing up, coming up as a baby dyke, my guest today was legendary on my college campus. Somehow, I don't know how, I never got to take a class with her, but all of my peer group did, and everyone likes to talk about her. And so she still kind of holds that legendary status for me. So forgive me while I sort of stumble around my words. Today, I might not be my most articulate because I'm actually nervous, which if you know me, occurs so rarely. I am going to open with her story, the first page of her memoir, which we're going to talk about today, and then I'll introduce her. On October 1st, 2003, I caught a branch in the spokes of the front wheel of my bicycle and hurtled toward the pavement. My chin took the full force of the blow, which smashed my face and broke the fifth and sixth cervical vertebrae in my neck. The broken bone scraped my spinal cord, and in an instant, I was paralyzed. There's no knowing right away exactly what impairments will result from a spinal cord injury. But as the days passed, it became clear that I had lost the use not only of my leg muscles, but also the muscles of my torso, arms, and hands, and that the loss of muscle compromised my body's circulatory systems. I also lost control of my bladder and bowels. The cord was not severed, so over many months, I regained limited but functional strength in my arm and to a significantly lesser degree, my hands. Lying in the intensive care unit of Harvard Hospital, I knew very little about the present and nothing about the future. I only knew that I had been grievously injured and was lost in space. Not until I reached the rehab hospital a month after the accident could I begin to put into words a body that seemed beyond the reach of language. That's from the first page of the memoir, A Body Undone, Living On After Great Pain by Christina Crosby. Christina Crosby is a professor of English and feminist gender and sexuality studies at Wesleyan University, and is the author of this memoir, which we're going to talk about. At once deeply personal and deeply unsentimental, the book is her effort to create something of an otherwise confounded life by diving into the wreck of my body. It's a quote. Most recently, she contributed an essay, Words Matter, Friendship, Grief, and the Intimacy of Maggie Nelson's Writing, to Frame, a Journal of Literary Study, special issue on feminist bodies. Her first book, The Ends of History, Victorians and the, quote, woman question from Routledge, explores Victorian historicism and the ways that women, so-called, must be exempted from history in order to secure it as a public masculine domain of progressively unfolding events. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Christina Crosby.
I'm really just very, very happy to be speaking with you. Yes, I am. We if you didn't take a class with me, as I now know you didn't, it's a good time that we can have a conversation.
So we're recording this on day 7 of uprisings throughout the United States in protest of the murder of George Floyd, ongoing police violence, especially against Black and Brown people, a government which favors the economy over people's lives. It's a scary time. I think it's a necessary time. What are you feeling and thinking about in these moments?
Oh, so much. I think I'm so aware of just a real burden of grief, feeling so terribly how life is held cheap in this country. I mean, the pandemic has made that so vividly clear. And then to have Black Death, I mean, the killing of George Floyd was horrific. And I think that it just amplifies the grief that so many people were already carrying from the pandemic. I mean, it's really grief for the state of our country. And I hope very much that by acknowledging that grief, we can actually use it to develop a politics that can address the inequities that are so clear. I mean, consider who's died in this pandemic. Prisoners, the elderly, seriously disabled people, and many, many more Black and Brown people have died proportionately to the population. So it's really, that's just a horrific context for the police violence, the state-sanctioned killing of Black men and women. So I think that grieving, probably figuring out a politics that can come out of and acknowledge grief, is going to be very important for us. I mean, I think about the disbelief that I felt after the day that I woke up to Donald Trump's victory in the election, and my sense that the world that I had known was going to and was in fact coming undone. And look at us. Look at us. So can we take coming undone and make something of living beside ourselves? That's really the question for me.
And it's a question that you explore in this book. As soon as the pandemic started, I began reading your book. And a few people in my life said, that seems like an odd choice. It's a story about like a cataclysmic rupture in someone's life. It's physical and emotional and psychic. But it was actually like strangely comforting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly yeah. Because it was defiant in its talk about, I think, grief and bodies and disability. And it was not this sort of hero narrative. I mean, I felt like you resisted a lot of conventions, right? You resisted it being like, you know, this uplifting story of this horrible thing happened to me. And now, do you know what? I'm a better person.
Yeah.
This sort of like everything happens for a reason. And now I'm a better person. And
yeah.
You're not going for that redemption narrative.
No.
You're not drawing a clear path of hardship to peace or joy or something?
No.
I mean, it's, you know, you really tell the truth in it, and you have this very open heart and mind, and it's so direct as to be sort of startling sometimes, but it feels so real also.
Well, my address is direct. I use the second person pronoun you rather than one or we, you, which we also use as a kind of first person stand-in when we talk about how you go to the store and then you forget something and then you have to rush home, and that's what happened to you this afternoon, but you're narrating it in the second person. But it's really that address. I think probably the book's greatest strength stylistically was, and it wasn't even a choice, I just started writing to you. And it's so interesting to me. I had a really hard time imagining that I would write in the first person. I think for a person like myself, who, you know, I'm a literary critic, I'm a feminist theorist, I'm a queer theorist, I had not written personally. In fact, there were ways in which I valued impersonality, you know? But the first time I spoke about my altered life in the context of the intellectual work that I do was to a group of students who were part of the Feminist Network, which is a loose group on campus that were organizing pizza lunches to hear from their FGSS, their Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies teachers. They wanted to have a more informal kind of conversation. And so I actually wrote out a lecture I wrote it out because I was so uncertain about speaking in the first person. But, you know, it really was a way of bringing together what I was teaching in feminist theories and the altered state that I was in, which my body requires so much attention. And so that was the very first thing that I did in the first person. It in a way it feels like it went full circle for me, because I gave a keynote address in the fall of 2018 to the incoming class of Wesleyan students, because they had all been sent my book over the summer. It was the common reading. So I gave a keynote address, and it took me several weeks to write that, to get it right. But I did get it right. And I was worried, you know, because the first time I was talking to students in the Feminist Network, this time I was talking to all of them, right? I mean, I was talking to the lacrosse team. I was talking to people that were going to major in economics. You know, I was speaking to all of them. And you know what happened? They gave me a standing ovation in the chapel. And I thought, I got it right. You know, so I actually think that it mattered a great deal to me that I had a you to address. And I think I'm very glad that I didn't produce the affect of you know, a teacher addressing a class, because that's not what it was at all. It was that I wanted people to understand, and I wanted young people to understand so that they could make something of their lives, something different than what they are given to work with. So
you say that you didn't want to teach, but there is quite a bit to learn in this book.
Yes.
I think especially about the way that you really gracefully weave in these very deeply personal stories, but also a larger analysis of disability, of home care work, of who does the labor of taking yes. care of people and bodies,
yes. Yes.
of race, of class,
yep.
and how those play out in both your personal relationships and then in the larger sort of society.
Yes.
Which I think is really hard to do in memoir. I sometimes feel like, oh, wait, now we're on the soapbox. Uh-huh. Oh, now we're back to the really intense part, personal parts. Oh, wait, now we're going to lecture. Do you know what I mean? I've had that feeling in reading some other memoirs where they go off into a sort of a rant and it doesn't feel integrated somehow.
Yeah. Well, I think that I'm very glad that there's a kind of organic wholeness to the voice, that it doesn't break into a clearly pedagogical mode, even though, you know, what I told the students in the keynote was that they better figure out what they want, you know? They better figure out what they want, and they better figure out what they want sexually. I talked about sex in that keynote and said, if you know, if you can think about what you want, if you can talk about what you want, if you can ask yourself what you want, the chances are so much better that you're going to get it and that you're not going to find yourself compromised in ways that you find degrading or in some way humiliating. You know, I mean, we all make mistakes in our sexual relations. I don't see how we can do otherwise, especially when we're young. But I think we can also figure out from those mistakes what the hell went wrong in order to have a more positive sense of what the pleasure is. So I said that, and you know, I got the standing ovation. So I guess it struck a nerve, as we might say.
I love that you talk about pleasure to them, because there is a lot about pleasure in this book, and that's what I want to talk about next. But we've got to take our commercial break. We have to hear from the people who make this show possible and give me money so that I can keep making it. So let's hear those commercials, and when we come back, more with Christina Crosby. Hi, all. It's pretty difficult to talk about things other than what's going on in our world right now. So delivering these ads to you are tricky for me, and I want to be transparent and honest about that. But also, these advertisers make it possible for us to do the show. And I believe in the ability of this show to help people. I don't consider pleasure something extra or frivolous or unnecessary right now. It is absolutely a part of resistance, justice, and freedom. One of our advertisers is Uber Lube. They make a great body-safe silicone lube with only two ingredients, silicone and vitamin E. No additives like parabens, preservatives, or petrochemicals. It's great for all kinds of sex play. Uber Lube adds a thin layer that leads to just the right amount of slip while still allowing for skin-on-skin sensations. If you need some lube, they're offering Sex Out Loud listeners a special offer. 10% off and free shipping when you use my code Tristan at uberlube.com. That's 10% off and free shipping. Just use the code Tristan at uberlube.com. Uberlube lets you feel what you want to feel. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. hey, it's time I give you my phone number, right? You can call me and you can tell me what you think of this show, what you think of other shows. If you have questions that you want advice for, sometimes we devote entire episodes just to questions. The number is 323-SEX-8266, 323-SEX-8266. I'm talking today with Professor Christina Crosby about her memoir, A Body Undone, Living On After Great Pain. And we wrapped up the last segment talking about pleasure, and I said there's a lot of pleasure in this book. There's a lot of pleasure in this book, first of all, because before your accident, you were a pleasure seeker.
Yeah.
It seems you prioritized pleasure in your life.
Yes.
And that was like physical pleasure and emotional pleasure. And you were really into food and cocktails and entertaining. And, you know, and I also should say that like when you had this accident on your bike, you were like an avid bike rider who was on an ordinary 17-mile bike ride that day, something you did all the time.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of pleasure in this book, but also once the accident happens, you feel like you stayed firm that my life will not be without pleasure.
Yeah. You can't live without. I think it's very, very hard to live without attending to pleasure. And I honestly believe that attending to pleasure makes us stronger in every way, makes it easier to take what life brings. So yes, I am a pleasure seeker. What do you want? Figure it out. And I think that when I was writing that book, I was struggling. I was struggling to find my way because I live with chronic pain, and that's debilitating. You know, it's wearing. It's corrosive. It eats at you. And I said in the book that it sets up a kind of scrim between me and the world where it's not that something so horrible is happening to me. It's just that I'm uncomfortable in my body and I feel at a distance from the world. I really struggle against that distance because feeling connected to people is very important to me. And I know that that was the main motivation of the book, was to feel connected with the world, given that that my entire life had changed. So, you know, in a moment, in an instant, and yet then it took Janet and me, I would say, 10 years to build back a livable life. She works at Barnard College in New York City. So we have an apartment down there. We've had an apartment down there for, you know, forever. And I have a house up here that I've had again forever. And we are living this two-place life that was just fine by me and fine by her, where we spent lots of time together because we're academics, our work can be scheduled in ways that allow for time together. But, you know, time apart was also okay. That has become, by now, it's just wearing. But, you know, we were active pleasure seekers. I certainly knew that I wanted to make a life that felt good. I've always wanted that, I think. And how was I going to do it when I'm Now, the technical diagnosis is quadriplegic because I'm seriously paralyzed in all four limbs. You know, my life is in many ways difficult, but the other thing is my life is abundant. You know, it's abundant. I have an abundance of love. How many people can say that? I have an abundance of love. I have work that I value. I'm relatively independent. My life is, in many ways, a very good life. My life is, in many ways, very, very hard and hard to hold on to. It's hard to hold on to the positive stuff. But that makes the positive stuff all the more important. And none of this is about some narrative of redemption. As you said, I find the downright imperative to produce happiness out of disability, I find that to be just flat out wrong. The most egregious, simple example I can give is a headline in the Middletown Times, the Middletown Press, about me. And my massage therapist and her friends did a community fundraiser, which was just loving beyond anything, to help me raise money to buy a van. And the paper wrote it up. The headline was Massaging Away Tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that.
Right.
You know, there's no massaging away tragedy. You have to live in and with tragedy. And that's a hard lesson to learn, and a very important one, I think. And the desire to hear a happy story, the desire to make I understand life better now. You know, that impulse to come to a happy ending. I like happy endings. You know, I like social comedy. I have nothing against a happy ending built in to a novel. I quite enjoy that. But I also understand that it's not the way people live. And it's certainly not the way I live. So I wanted to be able to assert the complexities, the grief, the mourning, the pain, the difficulty, the struggle, the effort to turn every day toward life rather than feeling the pull of not life. I wanted to communicate all of that as best I could. And I did it by telling about my life and really about the pleasures of my life. I mean, one of the things writing that book that gave me real pleasure was remembering the physical pleasures of my childhood. I grew up in a small town in central Pennsylvania. The rural country was just right there. There was no spread of the town. The town stopped, and then you're in the country. And I had a bicycle. I had an army canteen. I had my imagination. And I loved being outside and active. So recalling that it was very helpful. You know, the other thing about that, about my book, that I felt haunted by my brother in the book as well, because he died in January 2010, the very beginning of the year, from complications from multiple sclerosis that he'd lived with for about 3 decades. So we both graduated from college. We're starting our independently adult lives, and he's diagnosed with MS. And over the next decades, becomes progressively more paralyzed until by the end, he's truly, he can only move his head. And he was always the disabled person in the family. And then I broke my neck. Mm-hmm. And one of the most horrifying things is that I knew what that meant. You know, I had enough understanding about his life that I suddenly realized that when I would think, how does he live with that? That was now my question. So facing my brother in a wheelchair was psychically complex, to say the least.
Well, and that parallel, which happens in the book, it's almost uncanny.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And your relationship is quite interesting and deep and rich. And so to have this sort of parallel, you know, to have both your universes like come together in this particular way.
Yeah.
That was very powerful. That was very powerful. The writing about him. And also having to deal with his death, like in the middle of you know what I mean? Like in the middle of not being on solid ground at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And it was unexpected, which is so strange because he was completely paralyzed. What did I think was going to happen? But he was so, he loved life, you know? He was so there that it was very difficult to imagine that he was going to die soon. And then suddenly his heart, it wasn't sudden at all, of course, but his heart failed him. He could no longer get enough oxygen because his heart couldn't do the job. And I tell you, it was a timely death because it seems likely that he had aspirated some beer he was drinking at a Christmas dinner just before that. And the horror of a respirator oh my goodness. He was spared that, you know? So that death was in many ways a good death, even though it seemed to me a very hard way to die. And I don't, you know, I don't, I guess that what I have said in the book is that death presents a more benignant face to me now than it did before. It doesn't seem so foreign. And perhaps not so tragic, because it was time for him to die. And I think what is so difficult right now in our national life, not my personal life, but our national life, it wasn't the time for George Floyd to die, for Breonna Taylor to die, for Ahmaud Arbery to die, for Trayvon Martin to die, for Michael Brown to die, for Sarah Bland to die. You know, those deaths are untimely, unjust. And so the big question then, I think, is one that my book tries to address, which is living on after great pain. No, after great pain is living in pain. It's living with the pain. The pain doesn't go away after great pain. You know, the phrase is from an Emily Dickinson poem, one of her more famous poems, which tells us that we need to learn to turn toward life in the face of death. And that it needs to be an active effort in the midst of grief. So I think that the anger, the righteous anger that so many are feeling right now, this killing of innocent people is coming on pandemic deaths that are so out of proportion in this world of ours. So how do we acknowledge death, seek pleasure, live on, but live on knowing that the pain is real, no? Mm-hmm. Seeking pleasure doesn't mean that the pain isn't real.
Okay, we need to take another break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Christina about what she's working on now. So stay with us. Hey, listeners, Tristan here. Have you been hearing the word mindfulness a lot lately? I mean, I seem to see it everywhere in the media, on book covers. It's seemingly everywhere. Here's the thing, it's not just a trend. Mindfulness actually works. For me, practicing mindfulness and meditation has improved every area of my life, really. But maybe you can't make it to a group or read a book or go to a class. No worries. Just download the app that I use, Calm. Calm is the number one app for sleep, relaxation, and meditation, and over 60 million people use it. Calm has sleep stories, which are like bedtime stories for grown-ups, and they can help you fall into a deep, natural sleep in minutes. Stories are narrated by iconic voices like LeVar Burton and Nick Offerman. They also have soothing music from artists like Sam Smith. There are guided meditations, breathing exercises, and so much more to help you relax and de-stress. For my listeners, Calm is offering a special limited-time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/Tristan. That's 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library with new content added every week. Get started by going to calm.com/Tristan. That's calm.com/Tristan. Relax, de-stress, and find your peace with Calm. You may have noticed the flowers are blooming, the grass is growing, and it's time to mow your lawn. Thanks to our sponsor, Manscaped, you can trim the hedges below the belt safely and efficiently. You know I don't like to beat around the bush, so I won't. Everyone could use a little trim of their pubic hair. Manscaped, the only men's brand dedicated to below-the-waist grooming, is here to make sure your balls, people with balls, are smooth and smelling nice. After all, it's time for some spring and, let's face it, summer cleaning. I actually like to do grooming with a partner. I find it really sexy, but I've used razors before and I'm always afraid to nick their genitals. Scary. You have to use the right tools for the job. When I use the Manscaped Lawnmower 3.0, I know it's safe and it always does a great job. The Perfect Package 3.0 kit comes with the lawnmower, the waterproof cordless body trimmer, anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer, and the Crop Reviver to round out your manscaping routine. This third generation trimmer features a cutting-edge ceramic blade to reduce manscaping accidents. Millions of balls are about to be nick-free thanks to Manscaped advanced skin-safe technology. Subscribe to the Perfect Package and get a new replacement blade refill for your lawnmower trimmer delivered to your door every 3 months. For a limited time, subscribers get 2 free gifts. the Shed Travel Bag, a $39 value, and the patented high-performance reduced chafing Manscaped boxer briefs. You should really try this out, and I've got a deal for you to get started. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code Tristan at manscaped.com. That's right, go to manscaped.com and get 20% off with free shipping when you use the code Tristan. Your balls will thank you. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. We are talking today with Professor Christina Crosby. And when we were communicating, she was communicating with Raymond and I was in on the email at one point. Christina wrote, "I'm currently writing an essay on the COVID-19 pandemic, the labor of and need for care, the life-sustaining properties of touch, the Mobius strip of skin, and the recent vivifying book by Catherine Bond Stockton, Making Out." And I thought, well, we have nothing to talk about then. First of all, that like one essay contains, quite a multitude of things. Yeah. Okay, so tell me about this essay.
Well, this essay is very much in progress, so I must say it with that caveat, because I don't know exactly what will become of it, but the way in which, so I read an article in the newspaper about a physician who directed the interns in a New York hospital who were doing their rotation through the emergency room. They had rotated into that position as the pandemic came at them. And they were having to deal with death all the time. On the day that this piece was published, I don't know how many it was, 783 maybe? Yes, people died in New York City from COVID that day, and there were probably more, as we know. But the doctor told the residents to do this, that when they were with a patient who was dying, in the last minutes that patient was alive, to hold the person's hand. And after death, to just pause for a minute and say the person's name before moving on to the next gurney and the next crisis. And that this would, he said, that this would humanize both them and the patients who, you know, when 783 people dying in one day, it just becomes a number, right? And he wanted to say, no, not a number, a life. And how do you address life? You address life through touch and proper name. And that really struck me, because I've thought a lot about touch. I've thought a lot about the labor of care, as you mentioned earlier, and the way in which we all need care. But some of us need more care than others. And who gets care? Who gives care? And why is touch so important? So I wanted to write about touch in a time when we're actually socially distant from one another, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the hard things about this pandemic is the most responsible thing you can do is stay home, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The most responsible thing you can do is to not touch somebody else, is to be apart from other people. You know, this is very contrary to, I think, the persons we are, in the sense that becoming a person, when you to become a person from infancy, takes so long, right? It takes so long. We don't even have a marsupial pouch to put the infant in. There's nothing there. The infant just is flailing in space. I mean, you have to figure out that you have a skin. You have to figure out what's outside and what's inside. I mean this quite literally. As an infant, it's one of the first things that we begin to do as we're coming into ourselves. And we have to learn where the body ends, one body ends, and the other body begins, right? You have to learn, oh, that's my toe that I'm sucking. Mm-hmm. not the you know, a knob on the corner of the crib. That's something else. Figuring these things out is a real piece of work. And it's work that I think human beings must do to become the human subjects that we are. And that touch, that skin retains this deep psychic significance, as well as the simple fact that it's the largest organ in your body, and it's both inside and outside. That's what I mean by the Möbius strip of skin. You can't tell where the inside ends and the outside begins. There's always, you know, there's always that, you don't know where the final layer is, right? That separates you from somebody else, that puts you in touch with somebody else.
Well, and I think I follow a bunch of disabled activists on social media, and, you know, one of the things that's been made super clear to me, I identify somewhere between able-bodied and not able-bodied because I live with chronic pain, is like, are people, you know, feeling this lack of touch as like, you know, deeply are they feeling it? Mm-hmm. Are people feeling like, I can't be social with folks, you know, well, like, welcome to some of us in our lives, mm-hmm. where, you know, many disabled folks can't go out already,
right.
without great fanfare. And many disabled folks can't be touched or touch or aren't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For a variety of reasons. And you talk about this, you know, this sort of in your book, this love story with your partner, Janet, is pretty awesome. Such a not precise word, Tristan. Okay.
but accurate.
Okay. But you talk about being sexual, having a sexual partner.
Yeah.
There's this whole exchange between the two of you where Janet says, I am your physical lover.
Yeah.
I am your physical lover. It's a really powerful part of the book. Because you also refuse to be made desexual, yeah. as a result of your disability.
Yes. I think it's very, very important to claim sex, to claim pleasure, and to claim that as a sustaining and necessary part of life. It's not something that one can easily do. The need to be touched. There's a real need, I believe, to be touched. And sexual touch is part of that. Caring touch is one kind of touch. Sexual touch is another kind of touch. Sometimes they are very close together. And for Janet and me, you know, she is one of my primary caretakers, along with a woman named Donna and another woman named Shannon, who have cared for me now for going on 20 years, really. So Janet is one of my caretakers, but she cares for me in so many different ways. And the assertion of physical pleasure, the assertion of being a sexual couple really matters to me. You know, we've been willfully misrecognized. Now when we're out in the world, because it's so easy for people to imagine her as simply my aide or caretaker, mm-hmm. and to address questions to her rather than to me, and to think, oh, we're sisters. We don't look at all alike, you know, making up some relation that would explain how this person could be together with this other person. Well,
it like misnames the intimacy, because they pick up that like there's something going on here beyond like this person just pushes my wheelchair, but then they misname the intimacy. Yes,
they misname the intimacy. It feels willful to me. So one time we were down in D.C. and had had a hard plane ride. I mean, things can be difficult when you're dealing with wife in a wheelchair and no trunk control. You know, I can't sit up without support. And we were in sort of a little strip of gay commerce and went into a store, and the fellow there said, "Hello, ladies." My God. And I thought, that's perfectly right. Hello, ladies. You know, it was what he understood. He got it. He got that we were a sexual couple, and it was such a relief. So, you know, I feel the need to assert that as strongly as we can in the public world. And to actively attend to it in our life together at home.
Don't you think his addressing of you, though, is also part of queerness? That
yes.
Queers have been forever and ever redefining
yes.
sex and redefining pleasure and redefining, you know, desire. And
yes.
So it's almost like queer people get it in a different way.
Absolutely. You know, that was the pleasure of it, was the, you know, it was public sex, right? Mm-hmm. It was being recognized in public, and it was one of the things that gave me the most pleasure when Jen and I would step out in New York, because she's quite accomplished in high heels. And I cut quite a figure in cowboy boots and leather jeans. It really gave us both pleasure. We would call it going to New York when we would get dressed up and go out like that. So yes, being recognized as a sexual couple matters a great deal. And it's one of the ways in which my life is abundant. And I understand that abundance is all too rare in the lives of people who are living with bodies and minds that are unusual, you know, who are living with what Eli Clare calls brilliant imperfection. You know, I think that's the very best phrase that I've heard, because Rosemary Garland Thompson said that we are extraordinary bodies. Well, yeah, but that is simply an emphasis. That's just flipping it, right? Instead of looking at the disability, it's to assert something else, extraordinariness. I don't feel extraordinary. I feel brilliantly imperfect. No, my incapacities are real. We need to name them as incapacities. Think of the fact that you cannot talk about disability without using a word that has a negative prefix. Disabled, unable, injured, undone. Those are all incapacitated. You can't, and starting with disabled, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that Eli Clare was able to call this brilliant imperfection, you know, it's just excellent writing. That's what that is. That is excellent writing. And it's the title of his most recent book, and one that we should all read, in fact.
Well, and I think often this falls on language in that way, which is that there's a word and that word constantly gets centered. I mean, I think, for example, about non-monogamy, mm-hmm. right? I probably say that word 12 times a day.
Right.
And it is difficult to think of that the word is not this.
Yeah.
Because it automatically centers monogamy.
Yep.
Right. Even, and we.
Yes. Yeah. Even saying non-normative, right? At least
right.
that names the negative force of normativity, right? That at least you're talking about a social dimension when you say non-normative.
Right.
But still, it's as you just pointed out, it's still a negation of something rather than an affirmation. And no, I am not differently abled. I'm fucking incapacitated. But I'm alive, you know, and living a life that in many ways is a very good one. So yeah, the assertion of sexual pleasure is very, very important to me. It's why I wrote as I did in the book about that phrase that I love, my sex life, you know, my life in sex with Janet. And the fact, you know what she did? I'm lying there in my hospital bed.
I remember. Go I'm ahead. I'm sorry, people who haven't read the book. Go ahead.
In my hospital bed, and I feel horrible. I mean, truly, that was a truly, truly horrific time for me. So there I am. And Janet gets into bed. She puts down the side of the hospital bed. She climbs in behind me. She lies down, presses her body up against mine, and cups my breast with her hand and says, "I'm your physical lover." And she says that again and again and again to me until I'm convinced. Oh, yeah, right. I guess so. Let's do that. But it's also very real that sexual sensation is very, very different for me now.
Well, the grief, this is your point from throughout the book and from the beginning, is the grief sits alongside the pleasure, right?
Yes.
The grief of what you had,
yes.
What the sex life you had,
yes.
Which can't possibly be the same.
No, because that was so fabulous. It was so much fun. Oh my God. I've never had such good sex. And it's a great pleasure to remember, and it's a great sorrow to me that's gone out of my life. But sex hasn't gone out of my life. That kind of sex has gone out of my life. You know, what I say, and this is still true, is that I experienced a lot of joy in the years with Janet before I broke my neck. We were together for 6 years. And now we're going on 21, I think, something like that. And sex changes, you know, life changes.
Bodies change.
We're older. Her body's different. She's had cancer, you know? things change. And you need to change your sex life along with it. You can't just pretend. I know that sex now would not be like sex then. Nonetheless, my God, the memories of those times. I'm very glad I have the memories. You know, I'm just so fucking glad that I've got the memories. For a while, it was just too painful. And now it feels like a kind of resource to help us as we make our way, as our bodies change. You know, mine changed so radically, but it's still changing. And that's not going to be easy. I mean, what I say in the book is that what I fear most is the life to come, because it can only get harder as my body gets older. And that's a fact. That is a fact. You know, I have to be very, very careful of my shoulders now. I've had tendonitis in both shoulders. I've had long sessions of physical therapy to address that. It's really hard. But there are also these deeply sustaining pleasures, and holding that together without elevating one over the other, saying the pain is harder than any pleasure I'll ever feel, or claiming the pleasure somehow supersedes the pain. That's just not true. Life is more complicated.
Thank you so much for this conversation, for writing this fantastic book. Let me tell people again, A Body Undone is remarkable. It is heart-wrenching. It's joyous. It's uplifting. It's depressing. And it's actually sensual as well. It's called A Body Undone, Living On After Great Pain. It's published by NYU Press and available wherever you get books. I especially encourage you to support independent bookstores, which you can do online through bookshop.org.
Yes, yes, yes.
Thank you, Christina Crosby.
Thank you. I've very much enjoyed speaking with you, Tristan.
And thanks to Raymond Johnson, who is the senior producer, the engineer, the editor, the man behind me. Or is he next to me? He's next to me. It's a collaborative effort.
Raymond, thank you.
New episodes go up on podcast platforms on Mondays. Until then, you can catch me on social media across all platforms at Tristan Taramino. The show is on Twitter at Sex Out Loud Radio. And until next time,